Feeling lost and alone? Looking for validation from your partner, only to find the feeling of rejection and continued frustration? You're together yet so far apart. Now your frustration has turned into disdain and resentment. Your insecurities have begun to affect every aspect of your life. Ironically, you have now become the cold and detached one, shielding yourself from the uncertainties of your relationships. Dr. April Brown has created Bringing Intimacy Back, a series of discussions that are designed to help you reclaim what you have lost along the way. Dr. April will help you rediscover and reconnect to the intimate relationship your heart so desires. Go to www.bringingintimacyback.com today and let the healing begin.
Welcome to the Bringing Intimacy Back show. My name is Dr. April Brown, and I'm so happy you're here today or you're listening on your podcast to this show today. And today's show is a show that is about life. And so I want to welcome you all again to the Bringing Intimacy Back show, where intimacy is real. On this show, we aim to help you increase that intimate connection with your significant other, children, family, business networks, community, and your higher power. We give you the secret power to intimacy, to create a life you love, a love the life you create. And on today's show, what we're talking about today is intimacy and life. And today's guest is one of, sometimes as you are going through life, you find a little like treasure, like a little gem. And I was so lucky recently to find a gem, a treasure, and his name is Peter Covert. And Peter is a wonderful therapist here in Southwest Florida. And Peter is actually the founder, the owner of the Center of Psychodramatic Studies. Welcome, Peter. Peter, can you let us a little bit more about your life?
Welcome. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here today.
Yes.
I'd be glad to talk to you. I could probably talk for a long time about psychodrama.
Yes.
Psychodrama is a way of doing therapy. The theory behind psychodrama is called sociometry, and that's kind of the measurement of our social connections. It's a way of how we're different and how we're similar. Now, just think for a minute, if we were to go through, pardon me?
Okay, yeah, we lost you for a little bit. Can you start back over? I'm sorry.
I'm not sure where you lost me, but I was kind of explaining what sociometry is. It's the theory behind psychodrama being a way of doing therapy. Sociometry is the difference between each other. If more people were to look at another person, maybe somebody says something that's very unkind, and the response would be, I'm not like that. That's not me. As opposed to maybe taking offense, taking things personally. We're social beings. We interact with each other, and there's a lot of opportunity for people to become upset.
Yes. So, Peter, as you're explaining psychodramatic studies and therapy, curious, and then the audience are curious, how did you ever even get into this field of therapy?
No, it's a good story. I met a woman, her name was Dr. Natalie Winters, psychodramatist of some note. I think that she's practicing in North Carolina now, but for a long time, she lived here in South Florida. I actually met her in grad school, and she was teaching a class. And as I listened to her, there was something about her that I just wanted to know more of. And what it was is she gave us all the feeling that there was that uniqueness in us all. And of course, that's true. Yourself, doctor, there's no one like you on the face of the earth. You were there. I was talking to a young woman here just a little while ago, and I said, could you tell me five things that you love about yourself? And she looked at me. And of course, there's a great deal of anxiety associated with such a question. But with thinking, she was able to come up with these things.
Right.
But what was interesting were the words that she chose, resilient. And that's a beautiful quality in human beings. Mm-hmm. We're stronger than we know. Okay. And sometimes using psychodrama, which is a method where we can reenact something that has happened in our life to show each other how it happened, what was said, who was there, where it happened, and then reenact it again to do it the way we may have liked to. Is that clear?
Right, definitely, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Throughout our life, we are constantly taking on new roles and retiring roles.
Okay.
And a lot of times we become stuck in some role that just doesn't work for us anymore. So to sit down with a therapist, a psychodramatist, or otherwise, and to talk about whatever difficulties that we're encountering and what might work better, find a new way to approach or to solve problems that we may have.
Right. When you say psychotherapy, and I'm just thinking for many of us who are people out there listening, to go into psychotherapy, to go into counseling, to actually speak to someone about what's going on in your life, it's truly sometimes very scary. You know what I'm saying?
And yes, I do.
Because I know this show is called Bringing Intimacy Back. And when you go into therapy, you hopefully, for the therapist to work with you, it's got to be a relationship, a connection.
Very true.
Yes.
Very true.
How would you suggest for people when they're thinking about this, but they're also thinking, I don't want anybody to know, there's a stigma, there's something wrong with me, you know, mm-hmm. Am I sick? Or can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that the person who developed the theory of sociometry, he did not necessarily believe in the diagnosing of illnesses and so forth. He was always looking for a better way. He believed that we were incredibly resilient. We're stronger than we know. I think it's my opinion, and I believe it was Moreno's opinion, Jacob Levy Moreno. He was the person who actually started group psychotherapy, coined the word, in fact. He believed that we become sick in the company of people and we heal best in the company of people. We become upset in the company of people and we heal best in the company of people. What a psychotherapist has is really twofold. Number one, they can develop a trusting relationship. We call that the therapeutic relationship. Now, this is precious. This is something that can't always be done. Some clients, they don't just have that feeling of trust with the therapist. My advice, find another one.
Right, you know? Right.
So there's a therapeutic relationship, and then the second part is really where the work begins.
Right.
If I can get a person to willingly look at what they have avoided looking at, what they have refused to look at or resisted to work at, to look at, then we can take that thing and look at it and talk about it, and they're stronger for having done that. Does that make sense?
No, that makes sense. That makes mm-hmm. sense. Because also, when you're talking about this therapeutic relationship, and as therapists, we know that we do our best to build that in this session, we're also helping our clients build healthy relationships. So yeah. that they can, when they're out there, whether it's with a significant other or whether it's, you know, with family members, develop and learn what is a healthy relationship.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the show, helping people to love their life.
Yes. You know?
There's so much talk anymore in the world, it seems to me, about sex, politics, and so many things, fear. What about love? What is love? How do you define love? Now, keep in mind, this is a very personal thing. This is something that is developed for each individual. And just as we are very, very unique, There's no other Dr. April Browns in the world. And your concept of what love is very unique to you. Probably one of the more, highly clinical descriptions or definitions of love was coined by Dr. Michael Lukens. An American psychologist from the University of Massachusetts, and he called it CBI. CBI, committed benevolent interest. That was his definition of love.
So the first part is committed.
That's exactly right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So as we're talking about intimacy in life, and you're talking about this concept of love, and you put the word committed.
Committed.
Yes. So I'm thinking it has to be where you're committed to the person, but also committed to yourself.
Absolutely. Think of how many people that we may have met in our long careers. I know you've been practicing for many years. And they would say, there isn't anything that I wouldn't do for my son or for my daughter or for my mother or my father. And of course, the way that they say that, the spontaneity, it just the words come out very powerfully. You know, that's true. But I'd like to ask, what would you do for yourself? Do you have the same, you know, will?
Right. And you're so right, Peter. People struggle with that love of themselves. They put everyone else first, and in the sense of committed to even have a healthy lifestyle, to work out, to not say negative things about themselves.
Yes. You know, only one time in my 22 years professionally, I think, I was working for hospice, and there was a passing of a mother, and she left behind 2 boys and 8 daughters.
Wow.
And when I went to the house, it was here in Florida. It was in rural Florida, and there just wasn't enough room in the house for us all to sit around and to talk. And so they set up chairs out in, it's like a field just alongside the house, and we sat out there in the morning sunshine here in Florida. And the one daughter mentioned, "I never heard mother say an unkind word about anyone." Now, that conversation went on for like a half hour, and as they struggle, and imagine that. Imagine someone whose commitment was to see the best in others and to not give voice to the negativity.
Like you were giving in reference, I'm a believer that commitment really starts early in life. You know, as people start to model what they see or what they feel from their caretakers.
Yeah.
Yes.
You may have remembered from school, I don't think anybody becomes a therapist without studying a little bit of Jean Piaget.
Yes.
He did a lot of work with human morality. Where does it come from? You know, from my reading, from my understanding, Piaget didn't even, you know, think of himself as a psychologist. Of course he was. But he was trying to reconcile religious beliefs, spiritual beliefs, and science. Now, this was his life's work. I mean, he wrote that. These are not my opinions. And he said, children's morality comes from playing games. I remember the first time I heard him say that. Well, that's interesting. And you know, it's true. You take a couple children and a simple game, jump rope maybe, a couple of girls playing jump rope, and one of the girls holding the ropes decides to go faster than the other. Hey, that's not fair. if a child is not playing fair, they won't play with them again, now will they?
No, they won't.
Yeah.
Yes. I like that, how, like you said, your morals and values come from playing, yes. And life sometimes, I think we get so serious, we don't actually play as much as we need to and, you know, be able to relax and stuff.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely. So we're going to take a little small break. But when we come back, Peter, I would like to focus on the second part, because I know you said there's 3 parts. Is it 3? Yes. Of love.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Committed yes. benevolent interest. Yes.
Yes. So I would like to focus on benevolence. And of course, how that relates to therapy and building that relationship and who goes to therapy. So we're going to take a little short break and we'll be right back. All right. So in our break today, I would like to give you guys a tip. I understand that many of you guys are extremely busy these days, doing so much for other people, your significant others, your kids, your family members, your coworkers. But have you ever felt like you're just going through the emotions? And for some reason, you feel lost in your skin. Look around and you don't know how you got to this point. You feel stuck. And I see many people and I say, it's like the game of life. Like you're just sitting on the bench and you're stuck and you don't know what you're doing. So if this is you and you're struggling with connecting intimately with your true self, well, how can you start to fix that? Well, the first thing, and we've kind of mentioned it a little bit in the show, is to be aware of that internal self-talk, that mindset, because that is what controls the emotions. And then emotions control action. So example, if you think you're not good enough and you feel so insecure, then that can be a main reason why you're not being proactive in life. Because if your self-talk is negative, it's going to negatively impact you. One of the old things that my grandma used to say was, junky thoughts will make junky mind. Thus, for you, you really have to divorce negativity. Just divorce it. Change the channel. So to divorce negativity simply means don't think or say negative things about yourself. Your environment may do it, but don't you say it to yourself. Because you're going to be with you for the rest of your life. If you want more information about how to do this, you can go into my website, draprilbrown.com, or give me a call up or whatever. And we can talk and figure out how to decrease this negativity. So as I go back into the show, if any of you guys have any questions or anything, please give us a call. We're taking questions live at 888-627-6008. So now, Peter, as we are going back, and we just talked about commitment, because yes. Peter, again, explained that love is CBI, right? Commitment?
Well, according to Dr. Michael Lukens, yes. Committed benevolent interest.
Yes, yes, yes. So tell us about this second word. Some people may say, I don't even know what that means. What is that?
Well, it's like I said, this was kind of, in my opinion, a highly clinical description of what love is. Benevolence is a word that describes our willingness to do good for someone else. Maybe helping out the people who just experienced this tragic hurricane. Those are benevolent thoughts. I would like to help. And if I could help, you know, I see myself as feeling better, you know, a feeling of well-being to help these other people. This is a very, very human quality to have.
Yeah. Do you mean that love sometimes requires this S word, sacrifice?
Well, sacrifice sacrifice is another one of those words that really isn't, you know, that well known. When you think about going to work, you're sacrificing your time for the money or the reward, whatever it might be, that will come to you from this. Right. Sacrifice is part of all of the great religious traditions, as is benevolence.
Right.
The gods and goddesses, I think the first known gods that were the Sumerian gods, if I'm not correct, not an error here. And some of those gods were very tricky. You know, people were like the Greek gods. People were the playthings of them. But there were those who were very benevolent towards human beings in the Hindu tradition.
So this benevolence, can you are there certain pills that you can take to get it? Can you buy it from the store?
Benevolence. I think there's a wonderful feeling. I think there's a well-being that comes from it. Now, something that I use a lot is I think the feeling of love is a feeling of well-being. Imagine when you were a girl and you went to the drawer before you went to school and your mother had your favorite top there. And then you had that pair of jeans that just fit you well. You liked it and you yes. put on your tennis shoes. And as you went to school and you walked through the hallways, you just felt better.
Right.
A feeling of well-being. Yeah, it was those things that gave you a good feeling. You know, mm-hmm. they fit well. They looked good.
This Peter, I have a question that just came in, and someone mm-hmm. is wondering, you know, this benevolence is a great thing, and you get these good feelings, but they're saying, Peter, I have real problems. You know, my life is going on. I'm afraid my marriage is falling apart. My significant other isn't treating me well, and work isn't going right, and you're talking about this love and commitment and benevolence. What if you just feel like you just don't have any more energy to give anything anymore?
Well, it's very draining, isn't it, when you're facing some of life's problems, and
yes.
particularly in intimate relationships? My gosh,
yes. Yeah,
that's our safe place. It's our castle, and the person who we are with, you know, they're there. For us, and we are there for them.
Right.
Yeah,
so
it's very tragic.
Things. Yeah, and so they're saying, what can they do about it? Because the love that you're describing, they feel like they can't give anymore. And they don't know if they're ever going to receive.
Well, that's the fear, isn't it? And that fear is part of our world in huge measure these days, from my perception, my experience. We have to be able to confront these fears. And this is where the therapist comes in. You know, when you think of therapy, this is a very new field. I think that the first clinical social workers came about in 1932. That's my understanding, as a result of the Great Depression. The first mental health counselors like myself, 1974. I mean, psychiatry really had its birth, you know, in the advent of the First World War, when they were assessing whether people were capable of taking others' lives. This is a new field. So who filled those roles beforehand? Friends, people who you felt comfortable and trusted that you could look at things that you don't want to look. And your caller is very right. This is difficult when you feel that this love relationship, this relationship doesn't feel benevolent anymore. It doesn't feel like they really care about me. You know, a wise woman told me one time that, you know, in a marriage, in a relationship, one person may be working harder than the other person at some point, and then the other person has to come in. But the commitment to be with each other and to look at these difficult things and find a solution.
How do you know if someone's committed, Peter?
Well, I think that certainly in a marriage, as your caller defined herself as being, there's the promise of a commitment just in saying, I want to spend the rest of my life with you, and to go through the rituals and, you know, the things that married couples face along the way. Life is not easy. And I had a young woman, if I can just tell a story just a moment. I love stories. And she was talking to me about the difficulties expressed in her life. And I recalled a Mary Oliver poem, one of my favorite poets. And I said, would you like to hear a poem? And she looked at me and she said, no, I just want to be happy. Happy isn't enough. We need to have courage.
Okay.
We need to be patient. Now, these are the virtues. The keeper of these virtues historically have always been faiths. They've always been recorded by the scribes who were committed to religions.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And right now we're seeing kind of an assault on those faiths as being archaic or superstitious. But those gods and goddesses and deities that have been with human beings forever. I mean, April, there has never been a civilization been unearthed by archaeologists that haven't had some form of belief,
right?
You know, that they would find. Right. And what it was the embodiment of something benevolent, something that was good, something was committed to us. And that deity, they had things like courage and commitment,
right?
Love, kindness, patience, understanding, and forgiveness. I mean, right. You look at the Christian tenets, I think that it could be said that Jesus only taught about three things. One God, love, and forgiveness as being the way to that love.
Right. And as you were just mentioning, the faith, and also look, because you previously talked about fear and how many times we're stuck. And so it's that continuum between fear and faith. You know what I'm saying?
Is it stuck or are we resistant?
Are we resistant? Yeah.
Or refusal is a word I would rather use.
That's true. Refusal. Yes. 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 Yeah. And then even if, and even if you say we're resistant and refusal, what you highlighted before is that many times we have to be resilient to all these things and have that trust.
I think we are. I don't think there's another mammal on the face of the earth that is more resilient than we are. We are stronger than we know.
Right.
And just the fact, the miracle that we are here, archaeologists are saying that Homo sapiens have been around for 300,000 years. You know, I know they've said between 3 and 4 here recently. That's a long time.
As you said, that we're stronger than we think we are. How does that apply to someone thinking about going to therapy, but thinking that if I go to therapy, it's a sign of weakness?
Well, I think that that's just a stigma, and that comes about because historically being seen as weak is bad. But I think you could say right now, our experience over the last maybe 60 years is that weakness is good. You know, well, we're stronger than we know. And if you wanted to come in and to sit down and have somebody give you all the answers to life, you're going to miss something very valuable. You're going to miss the answers that you yourself have for you. I mean, every individual that I've ever sat down, they've got a PhD in their life. No one knows their life better than they do. And if given the opportunity to ask themselves the questions, to hear themselves say, I don't know. And that is, you might say to your own son or daughter, start with what you do know. You know, and let's take the time to think about it. It's like asking someone, what do you love about yourself? And maybe the only reason that they cannot answer those questions quickly, that they're not in their heart and in their mind and quick to their lips, is they simply haven't thought about it very much.
Right.
You're at the break, and let me say one more thing, April. I'm sorry, I've got a lot of words in me. At the break, you were talking about this voice inside of us, that this judge, they sometimes call it, this critical self, that's a part of the human experience. But if we do not confront these things, we will simply have more and more words that are negative. We will not be able to pull ourselves. We have solutions.
Right.
Solutions are made, but they're not made by hiding from them. They have to be confronted.
Right.
But as therapists, we cannot force people. They have to do this thing willingly to look at what it is they don't want to look at.
Right. Yes, definitely. So we're going to take a little break right now. But when we come back, I definitely want to go into more about, like you're saying, how to confront that that inside of us that negative self-talk, the thing that's inside of us that's pulling us down. What is some technique?
Well, that would be the third. That would be the third letter in that.
The third letter, exactly. The I. Yes. But on this commercial break here, Peter, I would like you to do just let us know what you do, where people can find you. Tell us about the Center of Psychodramatic Studies.
Okay. Well, psychodrama is a study, as is life, as is everything else. I'm a group specialist, board certified psychodramatist, and though I have a private practice, the Center for Psychodramatic Studies, that does largely individual work, I love to bring people together, community. Imagine people that experience grief or loss. They've lost someone that they love, and they come together with shared experiences and to talk about these things that have been too painful to even think about. And after a while, they develop the relationships with other people who have these same experiences. They compare the notes, how I am the same, how I am different. And in the work clinically, I've done group work I've done clinically with, say, people who are suffering from addictions of one form or another, to find out that they're not alone, they're not unique in that particular way, and that other people have these things, and to share their struggles and their triumphs. I think that human beings, we need to do, we need to create, we need to overcome. And every time we do, we become stronger. Yeah. So I have this practice. We're taking patients, and we have groups and individuals. It's, as you said before, it's the Center for Psychodramatic Study, and it's in Cape Coral, 1404 Del Prado Boulevard South. It's Suite 135. It's the Quality Counseling Services Building. And I'd be interested in hearing from anyone who would like to take this adventure to explore what it is that they feel is best for them.
Thank you. How can they get in contact with you, Peter?
Well, I have a phone number. It's 239-887-6217. Or they can go to www.petercovert.com. And we would be glad to set an appointment, to organize a group, and look at some of the things that people are facing nowadays.
Okay, awesome. Yes. Yes. So, Peter, as we've been talking about the internal conflict and a variety of things, and so now the second part of this portion, or actually the third part of what we're talking about, is some kind of solution. So how can, if someone's having this internal conflict?
Well, I tell you, it requires something that's just basic to humankind. It's interest. What are we interested in? You know,
is that simple? What are we interested in?
No, it is very simple. It is not, in my perception, it is not this highly clinical, you know, mumble jumble of words. We all have something that we are interested in. And if we can look to those things, maybe looking at our preferences, you know, in the morning, get up, have a cup of coffee. That's a preference. That's an interest. Organizing oneself. You know, some people have a very difficult time getting themselves organized, you know, making a list of what needs to be done during the day. To my way of thinking, I really believe that all self-esteem finds its origins in what we are able to do or not do. And if we have made a habit, a pervasive pattern of behavior, if we have made a habit of not doing things, whether it's procrastination, it's a sign of interest or non-interest. And this is something that we have to, as human beings, to look at. What is it that I want from my precious life? What is it that I might be suited for? I mean, I'm certain that everyone, and even the listeners out there, has probably worked for someone that they just did not like. But that experience was like a rite of passage. That experience taught us things. We are going to confront problems. Life is not fair. It's never been fair. I don't know of any philosophers or ancients or religion that has ever said that life was easy. It's not. Because that's where our greatest teachings come from. And to find out our interest requires us to sit down and think about it. And it's best if we can do that with someone else. There's actually a physiological difference in the way we think when we are forming words and speaking to another person. I think it's estimated that the human mind in a day's time will have some 70,000 thoughts. You know, little sound bites of information come and go. That's not going to help you get to the bottom of what you don't know. Start with what you do know, and then start working towards a solution, a new way of looking at a particular problem. You know, our interest.
And I do like how you mentioned about it is good to maybe look at our interest with another person. It's helpful if it's a professional. Because many times when we stay step up, and as you said earlier, a therapist has skills, but the client is, and each person out there listening, we know that you are the expert of you.
That is exactly
true. You are the expert of you. Mm-hmm. So many times when you're talking, and we'll help you talk about your interests and stuff, and you say it out, we can give you, we can reframe it and provide that back to you so you can hear it. Because sometimes we don't hear the things that we say or think or want or whatever. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes perfect sense. And then something else to go along with that, the vocabulary. Now talking about love again, there's not a lot of beautiful love songs. I'm not hearing them on some of the pop radio stations. I had the opportunity to drive to the airport with a couple of young people that were listening to some music, and they said, do you want me to change that? I said, no. I said, do you like that music? I said, not particularly, but I'm looking to hear if there's any mention of love, you know, romance or anything. And of course, there was not in that particular segment, but that's not to say that it doesn't exist. But if that is an interest, if loving is part of an interest, if you've ever felt that beautiful feeling of well-being in new love, that is something to keep. That is something to cultivate. And the thing that will diminish that love are the problems of life. Life is not easy. There's going to be rejection. There's going to be people that say you don't belong, you know, but we do belong. And sometimes to sit down with a patient and say, tell me a time when you know you belonged, and to have them go back, you generally see smiles come on their face, and they tell some story, and it's beautiful. Tell me when you have been accepted in the past. What was that like? What was there? These are the ways, the breadcrumbs, to bring people back to what I believe is a normal state. And that is that we have to fight for not just our happiness, for our courage, for our patience, for the ability to forgive others. Mm-hmm. Now, how in the heck is somebody going to forgive, you know, other people if they've just got this pile of stuff, unforgiveness, that they have not forgiven themselves?
Right, right.
Therapeutically, to go through that list of those things and take them one by one and discuss them. What can we learn from these things? You know, the ancients, as I said, I got a lot of words in me. The ancients didn't have words for depression. You know, they called it sorrowful, full of sorrows, or fear-filled. You know, the ancient Greeks had a word for depression. They called it anhedonia. We still use it today. A loss of interest in pleasurable activities. interest. There it is again.
Yes.
You know, and how do we reclaim that interest? Well, we're social beings. We talk about it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just even to reiterate this whole social being, because I've met clients and people who says, I don't need anyone. You know, I can do all this by myself and this and that. But in reality, we all came to existence between a connection of two people. But then we came on this earth through a connection of somebody, of usually a mom. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been a connection between two people who created us.
Mm-hmm.
And to get us into this, you know, world where we can walk on our own and all that, we had to come through a connection.
Mm-hmm.
So we started off connecting. So that's why it's so important, as you keep saying, that we're social beings.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
Probably the greatest characteristic that human beings have ever developed was language. Mm. I cannot tell you how many times I have met with people who were confused in the problems that they were facing simply because they did not have the words to articulate, to express themselves clearly. And that's another value in the therapeutic relationship, as you said before, is to listen to a person and then to try to articulate what it is I am hearing them say, and then to watch the people and smile come over there. Yes, yes, that's it. That's that human validation.
Yes. You know,
so a lot of times we just do not have the vocabulary
right
to say these things. But
right.
The feeling, we know when things are exciting, that's a feeling. We know love, that's an incredible feeling. Probably the only emotion that won't kill us if we have too much of it, you know? You know, and joy.
Yes.
Joy, my God, joy is so easily accessible through things like gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being grateful for what it is that we have.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Peter, you said so much, and I've got like so many things to say. yes, because you've just given us so much information. But yeah, one of the things you just mentioned, a great reason to go into therapy is it provides insight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
That's what it is, too.
Yes, which is what you're understanding yourself. And another great reason to go into therapy, it's what we talked about, is forgiveness.
Mm.
When you're in therapy and stuff, you will realize that you're not the only one who's had XYZ issues,
mm-hmm.
and that all of us are not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's yeah, so there's important. Nothing on this earth that's perfect, unless you know, you believe in the higher power, and that and the higher power is perfect. But nothing, no tree is like straight. Everything has curves.
Yep.
And once you realize that nothing is perfect, then many times you're able not to feel like it's guilty for what you've done in your past. And, you know, when you look back and you do the best you can with what you know, but you're also then able to give forgiveness to others, because that's really important, as we know, in those intimate connections with your children, with your significant other, is the ability to forgive, because your partner's not going to be perfect. You're not going to be perfect. Mistakes are going to be made. Hurts are going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is one of those words that's very loosely used nowadays. The language of Jesus was Aramaic. Now, that was kind of a... It's interesting. It's something that's taught in all seminaries and in seminaries, excuse me, even to this day. Alexander the Great kind of conquered the known world. He never got over to Italy, but the world as we knew it. And he asked very little of the conquered people. He said, "Teach your children Greek," and the language that arose from that was Aramaic. And of course, after Alexander died, there was some chaos, and then Rome came into being. And what did the Romans do? They built roads. So you had a common language, fairly common language, Aramaic. And then you had Jesus, you know, who Muhammad called the only perfect man, You know, we minimize some of these religions nowadays. No, we cannot. You know, they kept the truth, and that's what was so important to them. But remember, this language had a word for forgiveness. Aramaic had a word for a language and for forgiveness. It was ofes. And what it was is beautiful. It was an oath between the offended and the offender and God. So it had three people there. And the oath was, we will never speak of this again. So when you think of that, you know, as you said on the one break, how our self-talk can be so detrimental to us as we just constantly go over. You know, I was a children's therapist for 7 years. And the children taught me something. They said they disliked two things the most about parents. So number one were screamers. You know, in groups I was working with parents, I used to stand up on the coffee table and scream, and I'd watch the startle reflex in grown adults. Say, do you get it? You know, but the second thing that children disliked the most were people that always brought up the past. You know, my dad brought this up, and my gosh, that was like 2 years ago, which is like a million years for a child. But, you know, that's unforgiveness. And the ancients believed if you forgive somebody, you canceled the debt. You didn't go home and talk to your wife or your husband about it. It was dead to you. It was over. You will not breathe life into it again. Something that bothers me a little bit, and I've done a lot of work with addictions as well. And it seems as though when people go into treatment, they've got another therapist that wants to talk about their character defects. You know, what is wrong with them? Haven't we been over that enough? Let's look at what is right with us.
Right.
And when you think about how long it took for a child to learn to write their name in cursive or to tie their shoe or to braid their hair, you know, everything we learn through practice. Mm-hmm. And we have mastered many, many things. I think it's safe to say there's probably more right with us than has ever been wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think you've heard very clearly that a child will learn more in the first 6 years of life than they will in the entire rest of their life. We are very strong. We are a lot stronger than we know. And that's my approach.
Okay, yes, definitely. Well, we're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, one of the things that you alluded to is forgiveness, but also alluded to basically letting go. Yes. And so when we come back, Peter, if you could give us, when we come back, about three strategies on how to learn to let go.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Yes. So, audience members who are out there listening, of course, again, my name is Dr. April Brown. And one of the things that I wanted to start to let you guys know about is an opportunity called vacation counseling. It's something new that we'll be doing next summer. And what vacation counseling is, if you're a couple and you're out there and you're struggling and intimacy is struggling and connecting, you just feel like you and your significant other are not at the same close spot as you guys were before, and you maybe have things that you want to talk about or deal with in a confidential environment. Vacation counseling will be opening up next summer, and it's here in Cape Coral, Florida. And what we will be doing is offering that you can stay in a vacation rental, and we will be providing therapy where at the vacation rental that you're staying for the weekend, about 15 hours for the week, about 27 hours. We're only looking for about 7 couples next summer. And if you're interested in that, please check us out at vacationcounseling.com. All right. So, Peter, as we're wrapping up, and we've done this great thing about intimacy and life, mm-hmm. and we've talked about everything from the beginning in the sense of how we are connected, and you talked about love, and right now, we're talking a little bit about forgiveness and letting go, because many times there's things that prevent us from being the best person we can be. So, Peter, mm-hmm. what are three techniques that you could give our audience members who are out there listening about letting go?
Well, before we kind of get into that, I'd like to say something about sorrow and being sorrowful. You know, the ancient, these are Greeks that said this. The Greeks believed that sadness was about letting go or trying to get back something that's been lost to you, trying to bring something back that is gone, or letting something go. Now, this sounds very reductionist. It sounds very simple, like, oh, this is no big deal. It is a big deal, because if we do not face these sorrows and think about them, we can find the target. What is this actually about? And then we can learn from it. And I think that is the most highly prized goal of anything, any sorrowful moment. What is it that I can learn so that I don't do this again, so that I have increased my understanding, and most importantly, I have exerted the courage to look at something that's painful. I am stronger than I was before. And I think, you know, in working with fears and phobia, there are people who are afraid of everything, the agoraphobics. You know, maybe I met a man one time who was afraid of needles. And, you know, it stemmed from, as a child, going to the dentist's office, you know, sticking a needle, and he had to have six people hold him down. Well, that would do it, you know. But this young man was going to have dental work, tooth extraction, and did not want anything to do with any kind of anesthesia or something. In another case, found a wonderful woman at Tampa Bay Hypnotherapy, throw a plug out there, who was able to hypnotize this person to the degree that they didn't feel the pain. And of course, that does happen. There are people who are capable of doing that. That is our mind. That is our mind. This thing between our shoulders is very, very powerful. We are powerful. And if we are willing to confront the problems that we have without just the hopeless self-talk or conversations and talking about how weak we are, or how this is impossible, I'll never be able to, there's nothing, we have to employ our ability to think about it. And once we understand it, once we understand why it came about, how we can avoid these things in the future, we can live a life with greater well-being, greater commitment to solving our problems. Now, I served in the military, and this was back in the Vietnam War, and there were things that we were asked to do in the Navy that we didn't think we could do. But there really was no choice. We had to. Now, with life, it's the same thing, Dr. April. We have to face this life. And some of these things are very, very uncomfortable. Maybe all that's needed is someone to sit down and help you with that. Now, I'm not against antidepressants, or I am against some of these benzodiazepines that they're giving. I understand that they found a link between that and dementia. That was paper published by Harvard University, and that's pretty dangerous. We are kind of a society that requires a quick fix right now. And for some of these things, it may be quick, but we're going to have to sit down and face what it is that bothers us in order to let it go. Now, you can set something on the table for a while. It's just like with, you know, a person who's afraid of everything. You know, you get them to move a little bit closer. Here's a picture of a needle, like in that example, or somebody who's afraid of heights. Hey, well, just think about going up to the top of this building. We call it kind of a desensitization. But, you know, little for little, we have to keep moving ahead, because each time we do, we are stronger. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. And what you're basically saying, in this process of letting go, it is a process.
Oh,
yes. There's no quick fix.
And it's a process that's been with us since the beginning of our history, since the written word.
Definitely, And as you said earlier, many times back in centuries and centuries ago, people had friends and a variety of different spiritual philosophers, leaders, and stuff. And nowadays, as the world has gotten so busy and people come and go and have out of each other's lives, and the world is one good way, and learning how to let go is to go through therapy. Mm-hmm. And therapy, as you mentioned earlier, you want to find someone you can connect with.
The therapeutic relationship.
And this is that therapeutic relationship, and that someone that you can trust. And it may be the first counselor you meet, but you may have to meet more than one counselor to find that.
Yeah, interview your counselor.
Interview your counselor, of course.
They work for you.
Yes, of course. And I'm glad you mentioned that. The counselor is working for you. Mm-hmm. And definitely, yes, it is a process. And so as our listeners are out there listening, do not be afraid to go into therapy. It is one of the other things that we haven't mentioned, and I might have mentioned it a little bit, it is confidential. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So no one really has to know, but it is a way for you to go meet someone, talk, and just be you. And you can share and bounce ideas. And it's, I mean, I've been in the therapeutic field since 1998 and in private practice since 2005. So I've had clients who've been with me from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And that is just, it's a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're closing up this segment here, which I thank you so much, Peter, for being on the show, providing us with all this information. Can you say it again? How can people connect with you? Give us your phone number and your email once more.
I'd love to do that. My phone number is 239-887-6217. That's the Center for Psychodramatic Study. And I welcome hearing from you. You can the website, yes, www.petercovert.com.
Yes, and Peter Covert is spelled PeterCovert.com.
That's right. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Peter, for being on the show. This is the Bringing Intimacy Back show, where intimacy is real. I'll talk to you guys in 2 more weeks. Thanks.
Con mucho gusto. My pleasure.